I have talked about this topic in different ways and from different angles on two recent occasions, one of which is a Labour Left Alliance, part of the Labour Left Alliance series under the title The Bloody History of British Imperialism. And there's also a talk, which I think is called Under Voice of Revolution, called British Imperialism and Iran. I'm going to try and synthesize some of the things which I've said in both of these, but not how well I will do in that, I don't know. I'm going to start, however, I'm looking at basically the long durée, the very long history antecedents of imperialist intervention in the Middle East. For elements, the pre-capitalist in antecedents, to illustrate what's different about capitalist imperialism from its pre-capitalist antecedents, the emergence of small-scale Mediterranean imperialism. And arising out of the emergence of small-scale Mediterranean imperialism of the Portuguese Empire, and the parallel emergence of North Sea capitalism and its geopolitical implications, the intervention of the British, and the final point is that capitalist imperialism is normal capitalism, that there ain't no such thing as a non-imperialist form of capitalism. Kicking off then, my first point, Yasmin has helpfully put up. I put some a handout of notes and references for the meeting, and I refer incidentally to us right at the beginning to a set of recent books, Ozan Ozavki, on imperialism, security, and civil wars in the Levant, 1798 to 1864, Guillemette Crozet, Inventing the Middle East, Britain and the Persian Gulf in the Age of Global Imperialism, Peter Goode, The East India Company in Persia, Jonathan Parry, Promised Lands, The British and the Ottoman Middle East, which I reviewed in the Weekly Worker some months back. So my kickoff is previous issues which might be or are usually connected with this issue, but which it's inappropriate to connect with this issue. And the first is the Jewish revolts, which are a significant part of the Zionist narrative of the endless persecution of the Jews and a bigged up. It's actually quite difficult to get behind the Jewish revolts to the point. My point about this is that the Roman Empire generates periodic provincial revolts. And around about the time of the first Jewish revolt in 66 to 70, a common era, we've got the revolt of Takfarinas across the whole of North Africa in 17 to 24, Common Era, the revolt of Idemon in Mauritania, which is now Morocco, in 40 to 44, Common Era, Boudicca's revolt will be more familiar to people on this thing in Britannia and in 60 to 61, and the revolt of Civilis, or the Batavian Rebellion in what's now the Netherlands and northern France in 69 Common Era. Again, around the time of the second Jewish revolt, the Bar Kokhba revolt in 132 to 135, there's a Berber uprising in Mauritania in 122 to 123. London is burnt. There's evidently a major catastrophe for the Roman Empire in Britain, which is the background to Hadrian building the wall. But the historians don't tell us about what happened. It must have been involved some sort of revolt. And finally, around 140 CE, the Brigantian revolt in northern England, southern Scotland. So these are actually not this is not a complete list by any means. I just looked for prominent local revolts in the Roman Empire around the time of the two Jewish revolts. And the point is, the Roman Empire works by a combination of down to the time of Hadrian, wars of aggression, and the wars of aggression lead to the production of tribute-paying provinces, and also to the production of slaves. That there's a major source of slaves by conquests. With the Hadrian, the empire settles down within its borders. Slave taking across the borders continues, but it becomes a private enterprise operation. And eventually, what happens is that the aggression of the slave taking across the borders triggers border state formation among the peoples immediately outside and at the edges of the borders. In any case, we can leave that aside. The point is, the dynamic is radically different to that of modern imperialism. Second stage is the Crusades. Byzantine Empire suffers a serious military defeat at Manzikert in 1071, and as a result, in the early 1090s, appeals for military assistance from the West. And the result is we get the First Crusade in 1096 to 1099, which actually leads, after a big mass movement of peasants, which marches into Turkish areas and gets massacred, to an actual successful conquest successively of Antioch, Edessa, what's much of what's now Syria, Lebanon, and Jerusalem, the creation of the Crusader Kingdom, the Principality of Antioch, the County of Edessa, the Kingdom of Jerusalem. The Atabeg Zangi in 1144 retakes Edessa for the Muslims. And that leads to the Pope calling for a second crusade, which lasts 1147 to 1148. But nonetheless, in 1149, Nur al-Din retakes Antioch for the Muslims. And in 1187, the Battle of Hattin smashes the army of the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem. And Saladin retakes Jerusalem. I just make the observation that the Israeli state has not yet lasted as long as the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem. It won't be, it will be coming up on lasting as long as the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem in a couple of decades, but it's not yet lasted as long. The fall of the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem leads in turn to the Third Crusade, in which our own dear king, Richard the Lionheart, Richard the First, is heavily involved. He and the Egyptian Muslims fight each other to a standstill, and it ends with a diplomatic settlement. The Fourth Crusade in 1201 reaches Constantinople and ends there, and the Westerners take over the Byzantine Empire, or part of it, that the part of it that they can hold. And then there's a Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Crusade, all of which are trivial. What's driving this? But then, actually, what's driving this? There's two aspects to what's driving this. The first of which is that the peasantry and the landlord class tend to overproduce children. The peasantry tend to overproduce children simply because the only means by which they can save to old age for old age is to make sure they've got enough kids to look after them when they get old, and therefore there's a risk, constant risk, that you wind up overproducing children. So that medieval society in the absence with the abs with its absence of financial structures, which do start appearing at this stage in the Italian city-states, has the consequence that there's endless land hunger, and that land hunger of the peasants is also present in the form of land hunger of the aristocracy. That's social dynamic number one. Social dynamic number two is that feudalism involves a transition from in slave owner urbanism, the slave is considered to be socially dead, is considered to be outside the society, is not part of the religious and redistributive institutions of the society. And in the transition to feudalism, we get universalistic religion. So this is not just Christianity, but actually also Islam, and also in the Far East, Buddhism. And the effect of the universalistic religions is and the it's not the effect of the universalistic religions. The underlying social relation which has changed is that the primary producers are seen as members of the society. They're subject to elaborate status controls, which it produce forced labor arrangements or liabilities to pay rent of one sort and another. But nonetheless, they're seen as a part of. They're not outside the society in the same way that chattel slaves are outside the society in the conception of where they are. But the ideological aspect of that, which consists in the idea of universalistic religion, carries with it a contention at the edges of the universalistic religion. And in this case, in relation to Christians and Muslims, it's established very early on in Islam that Muslims are not allowed to enslave other Muslims. They may take them as prisoners of war and hold them for ransom, but they may not enslave them. And the Christians copy that rule from the Muslims and come to the doctrine that you cannot enslave other Christians. You may hold them as prisoners of war for ransom, but you may not actually enslave them. But you are allowed to enslave Muslims. And just on the other side of the coin, Muslims are allowed to enslave Christians. There's no problem with that. So this tension at the edges of, in the case of Christianity and Islam, competing universalistic religions, but also there's tension. I refer in the handout to the Lithuanian Crusade, which ran from 1210 to 1410, the object being to Christianize the pagan kingdom of Lithuania. And unfortunately, of course, the Crusaders carried on crusading after the pagan kingdom of Lithuania had, in fact, been converted to Christianity and only stopped when they were subject to a military defeat in 1410. But we also have the Reconquista in Spain and Portugal because the Iberian Peninsula had been predominantly Islamized in the 700s. And from round about the 1100s, and in particular from 1147, when the Second Crusade en route to the Holy Land stops at Lisbon and conquers it for the Christians, we get a process of Christianization of Muslim Iberia. We also get a process which is going on the other side of the coin. From the 1360s through to 1529, and from a certain point of view, through to 1683, of the Muslim conquest of the Balkans, which was previously Christian. This is, this, as I said, starting in the 1360s and going on, the 1429 is the failed Ottoman siege of Vienna. 1683 is the last attempt of the Ottomans to take Vienna, but ends in serious Ottoman defeat. I've put on the list a recent article about slave taking as a driver of the early Ottoman conquest of the Balkans in the 1300s. So the dynamic that's involved here, these are not by any means the only examples. We can also see expansion of Germany eastwards. The Lithuanian Crusade is a sort of high profile aspect of that, but there's about 200 years previous of German expansion into previously Slavic lands, expansion of England into Wales starting in the 900s, practically starting in the 900s, expansion of England into Scotland starting approximately the same period, but more sharply in the Anglo-Norman period, expansion of England into Ireland, again starting in the Anglo-Norman period. And all of these phenomena are driven by the combination of, on the one hand, the land hunger of the peasantry as a class and of the landlord class as a class, and on the other hand, of the claims of Christendom as an ideological entity, which expresses ideologically the fact that the primary producers are part of the society. Flip side of this, however, is that the military technology of feudalism is an artisan-based military technology. Cavalrymen are trained up from age 7. Bowmen similarly trained up from age 7 or thereabouts. The gear that they use is manufactured by artisan blacksmiths and bowyers and fletchers and swordsmiths and so on. And it's very easy for the technology, not only the military immediate direct physical technology, but also the social technology, to be copied. And I referred to the end of the Lithuanian of the Lithuanian Crusade. And the background to this is that Poland, starting out not as a feudal state, unlike high medieval Germany, converts itself into a feudal state and is in consequence able to see off German attempts to conquer Poland. Scotland converts itself into a feudal state as the Welsh don't succeed in doing so, and is in cons Scotland is in consequence able to see off British efforts at English efforts, I should say, at conquest. And in the relation between Christendom and Islam, although the Christians get back the Iberian Peninsula, they lose the whole of Anatolia, Greece, the Aegean Islands, the Balkans, to the Muslims. And the Ottoman Empire, as it emerges initially in Anatolia and the Balkans, and the Mamluk regime in Egypt, create powerful states, very considerably more powerful than the European states which are endeavoring to crusade against them. So crusade comes to an end, not because there's a successful imperialist project, but because the targets of conquest, the target people targeted for conquest, have won. If we We need to shift slightly sideways at this point. And in the late Middle Ages, we get in the Mediterranean and in the North Sea, the development of a new shipping technology involving much larger ships, which allow bulk shipping of goods like wool, raw sugar, and so on, grain, and so on. Docks to serve these much larger ships, which in turn entails dock workers and cranes and warehouses and all of that stuff. And shipbuilding itself also begins to become be industrial rather than artisanal. I'm going to flag up industrial. What I mean by industrial here is that it involves high levels of capitalization and that it involves coordinated groups of workers who are not artisan workers working in their own homes, but who are working under coordination, under authority, in the service of the machine. The fact that the machines in question are wind-driven machines or water-driven machines, as the case may be, does not alter the fact that this what's involved is what Marx called the real subsumption of labor to capital, as opposed to the formal subsumption of labor to capital. There's again, I will flag up a very common error of left readings of Karl Marx's Capital Vol 3, in which it's suggested that Marx talking about merchant capital, says that there is no production involved, that merchant capital is buying cheap and selling dear. So it's money, commodity, money. Actually, Marx says that of the activity of the merchant abstracted from everything else, and the activity of the merchant abstracted from everything else is simply the financial operation of a futures trader. The storing goods in a warehouse moves them from a time where they have no use value to a time where they do have use value. Shipping goods from one place to another moves them from a place where they have no use value to a place where they have use value. So the operations of the merchant ship owner or of the merchant warehouse owner are money, commodity, production, commodity, money, capitalism in the full sense. Now, this capitalism in the full sense entails, because of its heavy capitalization, a need to subordinate to the merchant capitalist operator both raw materials production and intermediate stages of production. It's unacceptable to have the degree of competition as a routine existence without one firm being swallowed up by another, which is characteristic of artisan production, or is characteristic actually of bazaar-y merchant activity, or the merchant activity of the merchants who wandered round from fair to fair or from market to market in the earlier medieval period. The problem essentially is that because the amount of capital which has been committed in setting up a shipping by the big ships, buying the big ships, setting up the big highly capitalized docks, and the circuit of bulk shipping makes it unacceptable to have that level of competition, and it's necessary to cut competition. In Venice, the big ships are built by the Arsenali, which is a state shipbuilding operation. There is state sponsorship of convoys traveling for security. In Genoa, that you don't have the same degree of state sponsorship, but you have the invention of really elaborate financial constructs, particularly the invention of marine insurance. And both sides, there's very extensive use of force to force competitors out of the business. Venice and Genoa, of course, fight each other over colonial possessions in the Byzantine and former Byzantine Empire and in the Mediterranean more generally, and they fight the Muslims and so on and so forth. We get cloth sold in bulk. Later on, the East India Company sells woolen cloth in bulk in Iran. So there's clearly a significant demand for woolen cloth produced in the Netherlands or in Italy in the Islamic world. On the other hand, we get sugar, intermediate sugar again as a big bulk shipping element. On the other hand, we also get spices. Spices are low bulk and high value. There's nothing to stop you transporting spices, therefore, by horse or and or camel caravans. But at the same time, it's also the case they're not a mere luxury. Spices are essential to preserving food, and preserving food ekes out, makes the existing supply of food last longer. And in the 16th and 17th century, the Dutch engage in factory ships. They have large factory ship operations which take vinegar and spices of one sort and another, and they hoover up the herring with trawls in the North Sea and process them on the spot, process it on the spot so that they're then selling pickled herring into markets all across Europe. Sugar is important in this stuff, and the relationship with the Ottomans is important, and with the Mamluks, because as I said, we end the Crusades with strong Ottoman state and strong Mamluk state, which sits across the supply routes for spices, supplying spices into Europe, but also sits on top of the primary production of sugarcane. And its immediate processing. And the Venetians and Genoese cannot just impose themselves onto their own economic interests, onto primary producers in Mamluk Egypt and Syria or in Ottoman Turkey. So we get, for Venice, we get slave-worked sugar plantation colonies in Crete and later in Cyprus. These are the precursors, the first step towards the sugar plantation colonies of the West Indies and Brazil, and the cotton plantation and tobacco plantation colonies of the southern United States. The Genoese move into more and more into finance because, of course, as I said, they're very innovative in finance. And they move into financial connection with the Portuguese shipping industry. And we get, again, slave work, sugar plantation colonies, exporting capital equipment for the primary processing of sugar and exporting the slaves, who are also an item of capital equipment as far as this is concerned, on Atlantic islands, starting with Madeira in 1419, then the Azores in 1427. Cape Verde in 1445, São Tomé in 1470. These are creeping down the west coast of Africa. And in 1497-98, Vasco da Gama famously rounds the Cape of Good Hope, cuts out the middleman in the spice trade. By a succession of forcible conquests of port stations up the east coast of Africa, some of which the Portuguese retain as Mozambique until 1976, the capture of Goa in what's now India in 1510, the capture of Hormuz at the Straits of Hormuz in 1515, at the same period, Malacca, the Portuguese move into Macau. Portugal becomes the Portuguese take over Brazil. Portugal becomes a global empire. At this period, I've left only the stuff which relates to the Indian Ocean in, because it's the global aspect is relatively secondary to our present concerns with the Middle East. Back to the North Sea, we've got the equivalent development of shipping capital in the North Sea. Again, we've got cloth being shipped, wool being shipped across the North Sea from England to be processed into cloth. We've got grain shipped from North Germany, from Poland, from East Anglia to the Netherlands, which is a relatively lacks large-scale grain producing areas. As I said, we've got these Netherlands factory ships operating in the fish trade. And in this North Sea milieu, in North Germany, in the Netherlands, in the eastern part of southeastern England, Protestantism takes hold in the early 1500s. 1568, we get the Dutch Rebellion and the kickoff of the 80 Years' War, 1568 to 1648, between the Dutch and Spain. Now, the context in relation to the Portuguese Empire is that the whole of the Portuguese Empire has been taken over by Spain as a result of Portugal in 1578 embarking on a mad idea of crusade in Morocco to restore the ousted Sultan of Morocco. Why the hell that would be a crusade, I don't know. But it's characterized as a crusade, and the upshot of it is that the Portuguese army is wiped out, including the king, who doesn't have any kids, and the country and its empire are taken over by the King of Spain. But the King of Spain is at war with the Dutch, and is at war with the English as well, as a result of the English Reformation. So we get in order to try and reduce the power of the Spanish to counter to reconquer the Protestant countries, we get the necessity for the Dutch, and very shortly after them the English, to embark on career of overseas piracy, conquest. The Dutch East India Company, the British East India Company. They respond in the first place to the Spanish efforts to try and restore feudalism. Spain is definitively defeated in 1648 in the 30 Years' War in Germany, and makes peace with the Netherlands at that time. Carries on being at war with France until 1660, and equally still trying to hold on to Portugal, which has declared itself independent in 1640. The British backed Portuguese independence, and Cromwell's army intervened in Belgium to attack the Spanish, and then actually after 1660, the government of Charles II, they made a Portuguese marriage, and they dumped a substantial part of the old New Model Army, the Cromwellian army, into Portugal to fight the War of Independence, which was in the end won, but it gets rid of the Cromwellian veterans and secures the British state as well. The France under Louis XIV now takes on the mantle of being the champion of Catholic restoration, which implies the restoration of feudalism. It's important to be clear about this, that when Louis XIV wants to set up a canal, create a canal, because the Dutch have showed that canals could be really useful infrastructure. Rather than creating a canal company or a canal trust, as the Dutch or the English would have done, He sub in few dates. He grants out the strip of land that the canal is to be built on in feudal tenure to a baron in consideration of supplying him with knights on horseback. And that feudal character is also characteristic of the nature of French settlement in Canada, of the nature of French settlement in Louisiana at the period of the 17th century. The result of this is that we have a succession of world wars. They are genuinely of global scale. They extend all the way to the Far East and into the Pacific and so on, between Britain and France and allies of one sort and another. In 1689 to 1697, 1702 to 1713, 1740 to 1746, 1756 to 1763. And then the American Revolution, the British for the first time actually defeated. But at the same time, although the British are defeated, the result is just the creation of another British model state in the form of the United States of America. The French state is bankrupted, and the result is the Revolution of 1789. Okay, now the British have equally, if not stronger, reasons to want to stop the French, because the French, instead of being the guys who are trying to restore feudalism and Catholic control, are the guys who are serious military political capitalist competitor. And so we get another set of wars from 1791 to 1802 and from 1803 to 1815. Now, in this context of Anglo-French global wars, we have a series of proxy wars between the British and the French East India Companies and their Indian clients, which end with British dominance of India. But Britain effectively takes over the Mughal Empire. Now, the normal pattern hitherto had been shipping, taking ports, engaging in a degree of piracy and enforcing trade monopolies, and holding states as subordinate states, but not in fact large-scale colonization. Then plantation colonies, as I said, island plantation colonies, which get bigger in the southern US. But the British now, having taken over the Mughal Empire, in the first place, it's fantastically lucrative, because this is not a question of inserting British trade into this, but of the ability to extract enormous amounts of money in taxation from a very wealthy, in terms of material production, very wealthy society. It also results in that the British become the controllers of the North Indian military labor market, which the Mughals had rested on, but which had been rested on by a variety of other regimes in the process of the decline of the Mughal Empire. And Indian soldiers are exported by Britain, are used by Britain, not just to hold down India, but also to take Malaya, to take Burma, to take African colonies, to intervene in Egypt, to intervene in Iran and Iraq, and so on and so on. In this context, then we move to the 19th century. And the kickoff is the French attempting to invade Egypt and Syria. Napoleon, well, I say attempt to invade. Napoleon, in fact, invades Egypt and Syria. The strategic aim is to acquire French control of Egypt, and by acquiring French control of Egypt, thereby to be able to create a fleet on the Red Sea, and thereby to be able to support Tipu Sultan of Mysore, who is the surviving French supporter in the Indian subcontinent. He's killed in 1799 in the Fourth Anglo-Mysore War, and there's a sense in which the British propaganda against Tipu as an aggressor is mirrored in today's propaganda against Vladimir Putin, the aggressor Vladimir Putin. The French, in fact, don't succeed in taking Egypt. The British Navy destroys the French naval force, which is backing Napoleon in Egypt. They prevent Egypt from taking Acre in what's now Israel. They prevent the French from taking Acre in what's now Israel. The British supply material support to the Ottoman Empire and themselves invade the country in 1801. And so the French invasion is radically defeated, and the French efforts to try and keep a toehold in India as a result of that are radically defeated. But the precedent which has been set, and this is most developed in Ozan Ozavki's work, the precedent which has been set of imperialist intervention within the Ottoman territories for the sake of quote security unquote has is then deployed repeatedly afterwards. Muhammad Ali, Mehmet Ali, Albanian military officer, creates a semi-independent regime in Egypt with British support and embarks on a large-scale land reform project. That goes on. The French invade Algeria in 1830. Muhammad Ali annexes Syria and a large part of the Hejaz in the early 1830s. The British respond by the East India Company taking Aden in 1839, and the British alliance with Austria forces Muhammad Ali to give up Syria and the Hejaz, Syria including what's now Israel Palestine. After Muhammad Ali's death, his successors are persuaded to accept a development model which, instead of being a development model based on independence, is a development model based on borrowing. And David Landis, Bankers and Pashas, 1958 book, is illuminating about the processes of persuasion and the practical consequence. The reality is, it's the idea that you can modernize by borrowing and then pay off the loans is delusive, because as soon as the loans have to be constantly rolled over, as soon as the financial crisis breaks out at the center, the loans cease to be rolled over, and there's then a quote debt crisis in the periphery, which in reality is the consequence of the false representations which were made in order to get people to borrow in the first place. And so a succession of these cases running through to the early 1900s late 1800s, early 1900s, and indeed, by the early 1900s, the whole of the Ottoman Empire is subject to creditor control of the finance, of the tax regime, creditor control of the budget. That is to say, IMF intervention on steroids, except it isn't called the IMF, it's called simply the creditors. Plus capitulations, which mean that British and French nationals are immune from criminal process in the territory of the Ottoman Empire, and so on. The Young Turks, the Turkish nationalists, attempt to get out from under this regime of British Anglo-French creditor control by making alliances with Germany and Austria. And in this context, we get the project of the Berlin to Baghdad Railway, Sean McMeekin's book from 2010, the project of the Berlin to Baghdad Railway is part of the story of the Germans' efforts to escape from encirclement by the British, and the British efforts to pursue a policy of aggressive encirclement of Germany, which will force Germany to appear as the aggressor when the when a casus belli actually erupts. And the upshot of that, Alexander Parvus in 1914, former leftist co-writer of The Permanent Revolution with Leon Trotsky in 1905, he still thinks he's a leftist. He argues in 1914 that the Turks and so on, if they join Germany, will escape from the toils of imperialism, whereas if the British and the French win, then the Ottoman Empire will be partitioned in the interests of Britain and France, which turns out to be what happens. Britain and France do win, and the Ottoman Empire is partitioned in between Britain and France. And in that context, we get the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the modifications of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the French mandate for Syria, with providing a homeland for the Middle Eastern Christians in the Lebanon, and the British mandate for Palestine, with providing a homeland for the Jews in Palestine west of the Jordan. Setting up, therefore, the roots of the present crisis. I've argued, and I'm going to repeat the point a little bit. At length, I've argued at length in the series of articles on imperialism and the state in supplements of the Weekly Worker in 2022, which I put links on the handout. Imperialism begins with capitalism. It begins with capitalism because of the capital requirements of the shipping industry. It begins with capitalism also because large-scale capitalism requires credit money. There is not enough gold, silver, and copper in the world for the transactions needs of a particularly of a reasonably moderately complex economy. And this was already the case in the Roman Empire, which a considerable amount of payments were made by paid by account entries or other forms of proto forms of commercial paper. It's certainly the case in the Middle Ages, where commercial paper payments by commercial paper become widespread. But payments by commercial paper, credit money, depend on the routine enforcement of debts by the state. And the routine enforcement of debts by the state depends on the state discriminating against foreign actors, because otherwise it's just too easy to run away from your debts out of the jurisdiction. And indeed, this was a problem in the early United States. I can't remember the guy's name who was working on this. It became an absolute problem for the eastern states that debtors would run away across the state borders in order to escape from their creditors. So this discriminatory character, the state has to discriminate, the state has to be a mercantilist state. Equally, capital, as big capital, needs to subordinate primary producers to itself overseas as well as at home. And the upshot, therefore, is, as I said, that we get imperialism in the sense of the export of capital for the purpose of primary production, which serves the higher value-added production stages at home, begins with Venice and Genoa and their sugar colonies, and continues, therefore, through, etc. And in the same way, it begins from the very beginning of capitalism. Capitalism is enmeshed in geopolitics. Now, the consequence of this, the political consequence of this, is that it's illusory to imagine that there can be a strategic alliance of the working class, either with democratic capital or with national capital. Strategic alliance of the working class with democratic capital is the line of the guys who are social imperialists, who imagine that you have to line up with the Americans against the tyrant Putin, or the aggressor Saddam Hussein, or the paleo imperialists in Tehran, which the Alliance for Workers' Liberty argues. But it's not just the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. There's a whole load of the German, the anti-Deutsch guys in Germany. There's a whole raft of different people who have this line. It's delusive because the self-identified democratic capitalists operate, quote, democratically only to a limited extent in their homelands, but definitely not in their colonial possessions, a point which was made by Trotsky many years ago in relation to the British Empire. Equally, it's illusory to have a strategic alliance with, quote, national capital, unquote. This has been argued, this has been a policy which has been pursued by official communist parties on and off, on and off, on and off ever since 1945. And it had a degree of plausibility in the wake of the social overturns of 1948 to 50. But of course, the reality of the social overturns of 1948 to 50 was that political power was already in the hands of the Red Army as a result of the outcome of the Second World War. Yes, the Red Army could hand places back to capitalism, as happened with Austria. But the more generally, the national capitalists, either they betray the working class, the alliance with the working class themselves, as already visible with Atatürk in Turkey, who the communists attempted to ally with, and Atatürk murdered the leadership of the Communist Party in the early 1920s, but equally visible with any number of nationalists of one sort and another. Equally, it's illusory to support the Putin administration in Russia on the basis that it's a nationalist opponent of imperialism. Yes, it is, but it's also actually a sponsor of extreme right, neo-Orthodox, and some neo-Nazi organizations of one sort and another. Moreover, if Russia wins this war, it will become an imperialist power. Well, it isn't now an imperialist power, but if it wins, it will become an imperialist power, as happened to Germany in the aftermath of 1870 to 71, and Japan in the aftermath of the Sino-Japanese War of the 1890s. Similarly, in relation to China, people have this idea that China has a more egalitarian relationship to the places where it invests than the Western powers. Well, yes, in terms of its ideological presentation, but that was true of France, had a more egalitarian relationship to the places where it invested in 19th century Latin America than Britain did. America, similarly, more egalitarian relationship than Britain did. But as soon as such a state is actually in power, It pursues the same old imperialist policy.